construction sector gets back to work under new Level 3 safety protocols today. To comply with distancing rules, some builders and allied trades will have to work in shifts, and all work sites will have to clear records. Will have to have clear records showing who has been on site and with full contact details. The industry is eager to comply and to get back to work where it can, but with some predictions of one in three builders to lose their jobs in the coming months, how close to normal can the sector get? Our guest first is Rick Hurd, Chief Executive of commercial construction company Naylor Love, who also speaks on behalf of all commercial builders belonging to the Vertical Construction Leaders Group. Rick, good morning.
Morena, Catherine.
So back today, could you explain what the impact has been and even will be under Level 3 on the industry? How are companies faring?
Well, first of all, going back to work is something we are very, very keen to be doing. And each site will be different, Catherine. We have some sites which will be nearer completion where we're doing commissioning and final adjustments. Those sites will be relatively unaffected. We already maintain very close records of who's going on site. We need to extend that now to the issue of people coming into reasonably close contact with each other. Interesting, listening to the previous conversation with Michael, we did consider the type of app he's describing, but to get that implemented across our sector in a hurry was going to be logistically impossible. We have a broad range of people and subcontractors from all across the spectrum on our construction sites, and to get everyone up to speed using the app would have been virtually logistically impossible. But we already maintain records. Our people on site already run electronic systems and manual systems, which will have to be extended to include the recording of how people have come into contact with each other. So it's relatively straightforward, but adds a lot of administration workload to our people on sites, but that's happening. So then the other side of this equation is sites which might be in the early stages of construction where we have heavy construction going on. That requires a lot of guys working in heavy physical activities, shoulder to shoulder almost in some situations. Obviously, we now have to look very closely at that activity, how we can separate them out. PPE, face masks, is the last line of defence we will use in those situations where people have to work quite closely together. But it's going to be, again, managed very, very closely. Where we can, we will split shifts, so subcontractors might come in evenings so we can avoid situations with people working over each other. So the three things we're looking at is the separation, the traceability, and the cleaning of our facilities, the toilet facilities, the lunchroom facilities, offices, and the like have got to be maintained very, very strict cleaning regimes.
So there's been a number of protocols designed. I understand it's actually different depending on where you are in the industry as well. We'll hear a bit more later about just how detailed that work has been. If you look across the industry from the very big players to the smaller players, realistically, what is going to resume and at what kind of pace from here, Rick?
It's a little hard to say, Catherine. I would expect most of our sites will be operating pretty much as they were. There'll be some which might be, there'll be some disruption, hindrance, if you like, through the implementation of the protocols. We might see a sort of 10 to 20% reduction in productivity, possibly a little bit more depending on the stage of the construction. But the good thing is we're back to work and getting the cash flows running. The issues now is, okay, what are the costs of disruption and who's going to carry those? Is that something we're going to have to carry ourselves? Subcontractors going to have to carry them, or the client? And our position is we think everyone's in this together. We all need to take some pain. So it's a matter of being very clear on what the disruption has been and trying to quantify that and then discussing it with our clients and subcontractors and managing it appropriately.
So the costs of that loss may be split three ways, essentially.
That's an ideal situation in a mature world. Unfortunately, we all have different situations, and some of these client organisations are going to be suffering because their value of their asset might be reducing. Their tenants might be on reduced leases, etc. So we have to manage the situation very carefully and understand each other's needs.
Is there any suggestion that existing projects, major projects underway, are going to be halted because of this?
Yes, we have. We've already got one or two projects. One has been taken through. It was a hotel, which has been taken through to a weather-type stage. They're not completed. I have concerns that one or two others may go the same way, but that will not be uncommon through the construction sector over the next few months.
And the cumulative pressure on that may lead to what?
Well, some companies which have got solid forward orders will be okay for 6 to 12 months until they complete the work they have. The issue will be where a construction company hasn't got a strong forward order book and all of a sudden has to go to the market, or not all of a sudden, but is out in the market looking for additional work now. Because my real concern is over the next 6 to 12 months there'll be a bit of a cliff for the construction industry, particularly that is privately funded. It's relatively easy for the government to support the public sector, obviously the schools and hospitals and roading type projects which are already in the pipeline, and they can be accelerated. But it's a different issue altogether for the government to sit down with the private sector and look at private sector projects and how they can stimulate that activity, which is unfortunately about 80% of the vertical construction sector and the residential construction sector.
Is that conversation happening?
It is. I had an hour on the phone with Jenny Solisa on Friday, actually, and the other ministers are interested through what's happening at the construction accord, and so they are listening. But we need to see some positive action in the next 2 or 3 weeks or a month at least to see what's happening for the government. What actually are they going to do to help stimulate that private sector investment?
Do you still fear for the jobs of one in three builders in the coming months?
That is certainly a possibility if there's no means to effectively stimulate private sector investment. Catherine, yes, it's a real possibility.
How could a government provide that stimulus?
Again, it's got to be done on a case-by-case basis. Many, many projects will be different. For example, it might be an apartment building where the government might say, look, we will take a couple of floors for emergency accommodation. That will sweeten that deal. It will get that project over the break-even line. They may be looking at underwriting risk in some projects. I don't necessarily see the government have to invest cash even. We might have a situation with one of the major iwi developers, Tainui or Ngāi Tahu, might have a project on their books which is marginal under the current economic outlook, but the government might want to stimulate that by offering them some surplus land elsewhere as what they can take on as their project margin, in fact. So there's each case has to be looked on a case-by-case basis. There's plenty of university work in the pipeline at the moment, which is now on hold because of the downturn in foreign students coming into the country. The government needs to understand that we will probably be in a 6 to 12 months a very, very attractive place for foreign students, and we managed to eliminate COVID-19 as we are. And it actually could stimulate foreign students coming to New Zealand. So they might need to take a punt on that and start underwriting some of the accommodation halls, additional lecture theatres, et cetera, that a lot of the universities are proposing. So they need to look at, they need to be innovative, they need to be creative, and they need to talk to the major client groups and say, what can we do to underwrite your, not necessarily underwrite, but to stimulate the projects you have.
And they need to be quick by the sounds of it.
They need to be very quick, Catherine, because there's... I think I've said before on your show, this is a cash flow business, and once cash flows are turned off, the construction companies, particularly the SMEs and weaker main contractors, get a position where they have to go into liquidation.
Thank you, Naylor Love, Chief Executive Rick Hurd. He is also with the Vertical Construction organisation. He has been part of the industry standard setting body, also Construction Health and Safety New Zealand, and they have developed a level 3 standard, quite detailed, I have it in front of me here, quite detailed protocols, hygiene protocols, also communications protocols, briefings that have to be carried out, communicated before a person enters a site, with language and cultural requirements taken into account, and very detailed practical protocols as well for the cleaning of gear, etc. It's 29 minutes to 10. You're listening to 9 to Noon. Listening into that now, our next two guests, and we welcome them. David Kelly is Chief Executive of Master Builders. Hello, David.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine.
Chief Executive of Construction Health and Safety New Zealand is Chris Alderson. Thank you too for your time, Chris.
Yeah, good morning.
Do you want to pick up on the health and safety guidelines and just how they have been developed for Level 3 and what's involved?
Yeah, sure. Look, I guess you know, the construction industry been mainly in furlough for the last 5 weeks. We had an opportunity very early on to make sure that we could do some thinking and some forward thinking that we thought would be acceptable to government. So, you know, we would have a fast transition into Level 3, which was by no means guaranteed. So, look, we first of all created a standard which goes right across the industry, which really explains what organisations involved with construction need to accomplish. And then underneath that, we created what we call protocols, which is some advice and some guidance for different parts of the sector saying how they might achieve those standards. Because at the end of the day, it's the guys actually working at the coalface and on those sites that actually have to implement this. So we do need to have a little bit of flexibility. So, Yeah.
Could you give us some more detail? Obviously, it's different at different levels, but what are some of the links that people are going to have to go through on the site each day?
I think Rick covered some of it. And, you know, the most important things, first of all, is just, you know, because we have been away from our sites, you know, for 4 to 5 weeks, which is really unusual, making sure that they are safe, so that your scaffolding's still up to spec, that everything was as you left it, because we did down tools quite fast. Making sure that we're communicating with our workforce as well, and we're giving them the confidence to come back to work in a safe way, because they've all been in their bubbles, you know, for 5 weeks. And some of them will be worried about, you know, what they're going to be exposed to coming back into the work, world of work. So those protocols really talk about, hey, let's have a plan, first of all. Make sure that your workers are involved in that plan, that you're communicating what that plan is, to understand the requirements of, or the change requirements of what they're doing when they're signing in to a site, what they're doing hygiene-wise, what they're doing from a separation point of view. So the 2 metres has come down to 1 metre for work. You know, how does that work? And obviously with construction and building, you know, it's a physical environment. So we really need to think through how we actually achieve some of the tasks we used to achieve in a different way.
The 1 metre, the move from 2 metres, which is what it is for people out in public, to 1 metre, how was that determined?
It was determined, I guess, first of all, as a nod to the World Health Organization. So I think 2 weeks ago, they changed their advice from 2 metres down to 1 metre. Having said that, as we said before, 2 metres out in public, it's very hard to do contact tracing. Whereas in work or in education, you actually know who's on your site, you know who they're working with, so it's a lot easier. So the 1 metre was relaxed, the 2 metres was relaxed down to 1 metre because we actually are able to put stricter controls in that work environment. And the last thing we want is the second wave, obviously, kicking off. But what all the controls are designed really to try and prevent that.
Not using PPEs, the likes of masks and gloves, etc., the thinking on that?
Yeah, so what we've found is that masks themselves internationally are used in populations where they've got high amounts of community transmission. They're designed to actually stop someone who is symptomatic spreading the disease. To actually use a mask in the work environment to actually prevent getting COVID-19 requires quite a high level of training. And we see that obviously in the medical and in the health area. So, look, using a mask in a construction environment, the benefit of using that mask really didn't outweigh the actual problems that we're actually facing actually using a mask in that environment. The other thing we sort of considered as well is we didn't want to create sort of a national stock shortage on things like masks and gloves when all those stocks really need to be prioritised for our health workers at the moment.
Thank you. Chris Alderson's Chief Executive of Construction Health and Safety New Zealand. It's developed the new COVID-19 health and safety guidelines for work sites alongside Master Builders and New Zealand Certified Builders. 24 minutes to 10, and David Kelly, as I said, Chair of the Construction Industry Association, Council and Chief Executive of the Register Master Builders Association. Just picking up on the discussion we had with Rick earlier, where is your industry, where are your members at after this break and going back with still reduced productivity going back today? How do you sum up where things are at?
I think, number one, similar to Rick heard, I think builders, big and small, will be relieved to be back on site. Obviously, the last four, almost 5 weeks has been pretty stressful for people. They're worried about their cash flow, as Rick said, and also about making sure they can retain their staff. So finding out last week and then getting back on site today is critical. There's a few areas of focus. It will take a couple of days for people to get themselves set up, and there will be a loss of productivity, but there'll be a focus on, in the residential area, completing certain stage developments, making sure that they're signed off by the local authorities so they can actually invoice and get the cash flow going again. I think the big issues are the forward work program. There are a few, not hearing a lot of drop-offs from confirmed clients who'd already completed design, but it's really those future clients. That's where the big focus will turn to over the next few weeks.
And what is the concern about that? What's the sort of situation you think you may be entering?
So I think just to describe the difference from the other parts of the construction sector, the horizontal construction or infrastructure, as Rick Hurd said, relies on a lot of central government work in particular and local government work, and it's not so hard to bring that forward. Vertical, large commercial, less so, but there's a bit of that. In the residential, there's really only one agency that does anything at scale, and that's Kāinga Ora. And they will be bringing more work forward. However, the vast majority of work in residential is from individual consumers, literally tens of thousands of consumers making individual decisions. That's the big area that we need to focus on. There will be some people who've been thinking about building a new home or undertaking an extension or big alteration, and they won't be in a position to do that because they've lost their job or their partner or they're worried about it. The bigger concern for me, though, because you can't do a lot about that, but the big area for concern for me is people who are thinking but are just generally worried about the economy or hearing the doom and gloom. And historically, we have seen a slowdown in that work. For some people, it actually might be the best time to do the work. And so putting information in front of people. So finance, mortgage rates will be as low as they've ever been. Much greater availability of builders or tradespeople compared to the last few years. If people wait, they may miss the boat because then everyone else jumps in at the same time. So critical for me is, I think, giving people information so they can make informed decisions.
So your real fear is possibly the next, 6 months or so, while people wait to see how things shake down in the housing market more generally, which we're just about to discuss.
I think probably 12 to 18 months even, I'd go out that far. Because again, it's as much as anything, it's a psychological thing. And putting, as I say, I'll repeat, putting information in front of people so they can make informed decisions. The issue about what the property market does is real, but part of that is thinking this is not a 12 or 18 month investment. If you're building a new home, this is a multi-year investment. And what we have seen is that property does come back quite strongly. So if you wait until it's on the upswing, then again, as I say, you may have missed the boat. So allowing people just to think through, what is your time horizon? What are you trying to achieve here? If you're building a new home, this is something you want over a long period of time. The other area, Catherine, is that there will be people, and we know already anecdotally, people thinking about property from an investment point of view. So what do we need to do to support those people? What do we need to do to support the property developers so that they have confidence to go ahead? And that's an area that we're in discussion with the government about.
Are you worried about that right now? Because we've seen in some areas where there's been pressure for new houses, the two biggest cities and certainly the capital has been of late, we've seen a lot of new developments going up. Well, I'm not talking, you know, big apartments, but, you know, maybe townhouse developments of between 5 to maybe 20 units. And is that something that your industry works on? Are you concerned about the future of some of those projects, including ones that are underway?
Not so much about what's underway. I think it's more the future pipeline. I think I am concerned about it, but I also think there's an opportunity. that for some people, as I say, who will be thinking about, look, I've got some money, where do I invest my money? Putting it in the bank on term deposits, not particularly attractive. Going into the share market, people will be uncertain about. Property historically has been a pretty good investment, but if the property developers cannot access the finance, then they don't have that opportunity.
So are you issuing a plea for the government to support the private property development sector?
I think we need to not as bluntly as that. I think what we do need to think about is what's getting in the way of residential construction and what could we do different. But it's not a handout. I'm certainly not asking for that.
I'll give you a minute to elaborate what it might look like, David.
I think part of it is thinking about how you might underwrite part of the development. Now, we don't want poor quality developments going ahead, and that will be part of the conundrum. I don't have the answer, but I think that's something that we need to discuss with government and others. What would get in the way of further residential development? Because if we don't have it, the impact of that is there are about 250,000 people directly employed in the sector. Directly and indirectly, it's 500,000 people. It is a significant part of our economy. And if construction, in particular residential construction, collapses, our whole economy is in a big hole. And I'd rather have people working than on the dole.
Thank you. David Kelly is Chair of the Construction Industry Council and Chief Executive of the Registered Master Builders Association.